From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made on this coming Tuesday when Rochester Democrats hold their primary elections. On the ballot are three candidates for mayor of Rochester: incumbent Lovely Warren, county legislator and former police chief James Shepard, and longtime local journalist Rachel Barnhart. All candidates were ready to debate here with Voice of the Voter, of which WXXI is, of course, a proud member. That debate was postponed due to the mayor's allergic reaction that led to her hospitalization. As soon as WXXI knew that we would not be hosting a televised debate, we reached out to all three candidates to schedule another hour each with the candidates. Two accepted, the mayor declined, citing scheduling issues. We have made clear to the campaigns that we would be extremely flexible with scheduling to ensure their choice of slots. The mayor's campaign told us they understood, but nothing on her calendar was movable before the election over these last few weeks. So next hour, we will sit down with Rachel Barnhart. This hour, we sit down with the former police chief and county legislator James Shepard. Welcome back to the program, Jim.
Thank you.
Local leaders, including former Mayor Bob Duffy, are busy right now trying to convince Amazon to build its next big operation center here in Rochester. Those are the headlines. Amazon's looking for a sort of a second city home. They want 50,000 new jobs. You think Rochester's got a chance to land those jobs, Jim?
I do. I think, you know, when we talk about Rochester, I think about the Rochester, you know, area, Monroe County. But I think that based on the infrastructure that we have, based on the collaborative relationship we have with the Greater Rochester Enterprise and the Chamber of Commerce and the Empire State Development, that we can make it known to them that we can meet their needs, not just in terms of facilities, but in terms of the amenities that, you know, employees want to have in the region that they work.
You know, it's impossible to sort of approximate what exactly a phone call would sound like privately between, I don't know, a mayor, Jim Shepard, and Jeff Bezos from Amazon. But if you're on the phone with him and he says, look, we're down to the last few cities here, Rochester's in the running, what is the pitch that's going to put Rochester over the top, Jim?
Well, I think in terms of our colleges, you know, RIT, U of R, we have, I think we're number one in the country relative to STEM graduates, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. I think that we have a lot of those graduates who end up going other places based on the fact that we don't have the employment opportunities here. So we would love to keep them here. And based on the fact that they're outstanding students and graduates, that they would serve that company well. I think in terms of us wanting them to be here, because it's about recruiting, it's not about, you know, demanding you do it our way, that no matter where it was, basically in, you know, Rochester or Monroe County, we would do the things that would make it feasible for the workers to get to them. You know, one of the things I've thought about is in terms of RTS, you know, rather than having a route that stops at every stop along the way, you have a direct route, you know, from the transit center to Amazon. And I think that would help to encourage them to want to come.
Okay. And I'm also curious to know where you would view the line when it comes to what you could do for what we would call subsidies or special giveaways. I mean, is this a case where you roll out the red carpet and you say anything you want, you get? You know, do you draw the line somewhere? Everyone's competing, so tax breaks become a big sort of competitive hook. How far would you go in this case?
Well, I think it's important to have a discussion with, say, the county, have a discussion with the other towns relative to us wanting to make this happen. I don't think we want to necessarily give away the store, but at the same time, we're in a recruitment mode. And so we'd want to have a package that would make them choose Rochester first.
And so when you talk about the county and other towns here, you know, one of your opponents who's going to be on next hour has said you do that too often. You're too regional, regionally focused, whereas the city needs a champion for the city itself. That we've seen population loss, we've seen job loss in the city limits, and you've talked a lot about Rochester's place in the region. Do you feel any differently about that? Why do you talk about Rochester in a regionally centric context?
Because I think between Monroe County and the city of Rochester, we have a symbiotic relationship. And what that means is we rely on each other. And I think when we're talking about jobs, we can't dictate. You know, we can't go to Amazon and say, listen, you're going to put this at the corner of Hudson and Upper Falls because that's where people can walk to it and they don't have to worry about transportation. Or it has to be on a bus line because that serves our need. I think we have to be in a recruitment mode where we're telling them, listen, we want you to come here. We want to be able to have jobs for city residents. And we're willing to work with RTS. We're willing to work with the other entities, the county, the other towns, wherever we put it. We want to be able to create jobs and get our people to those jobs, overcome those obstacles, whether it's transportation or daycare.
But does that put the Henriettas of the world, who have a lot of jobs and a lot of sort of bigger chain, that kind of thing, does that put them in the position of strength? And are you giving up too much for Rochester? Are you rolling over too much instead of fighting hard for the city, Jim?
I think in terms of jobs, and we know that we have such a concentration of poverty in the city of Rochester. We know that when that company comes, they're going to be looking for employees that have certain skill sets. So it's not a matter of rolling over and say, take advantage of us. I think it's a matter of looking at it, what's best for city of Rochester, what's best for our area. Because at the end of the day, if they bring 2,000 jobs or say 20,000 jobs here, if cities city residents are able to get those jobs, it's a win-win for everybody. And if you think about Kodak, you know, Kodak had a huge footprint within the city of Rochester, but they also had a huge footprint out in Gates on Elm Grove Road. So I think as long as we can arrange for our people to get to those jobs, we will have done our job.
Okay, so now let's set aside Amazon, because I think it's still safe to assume that Rochester's a long shot in that case. And listeners will have a conversation on Monday at noon with local leaders about what's going to be done to at least try to put Rochester in the running for Amazon. But let's set aside and let's assume that's not going to happen, because that's kind of a shoot for the moon kind of a solution. Let's talk a little bit about jobs and poverty. What is the overarching Shepherd plan to create jobs or to also make them more accessible, Jim?
I think in terms of creating jobs, we have to be recruiters. We have to reach out to various businesses and encourage them to come to the city of Rochester or come to the region, what we have to offer here. In looking at various communities that have been successful in recruiting corporations, companies that bring jobs, what you find is that they are interested in the region as well. You know, what do you have in terms of the arts? What are the amenities that, you know, if employees are in our company, what would they enjoy besides being within your city limits? And so I think we have to be able to articulate that and make that happen. In terms of who we would reach out to, I think there's any number of industries that we can reach out to that could bring jobs. And we want, you know, in my mind, we want large numbers of jobs. You know, if we can get somebody to come here and bring 2,000 jobs, great. One of the things I've always talked about is the call centers, because if you get into the call center business, it doesn't necessarily take a high skill level, but at the same time, they will train you. And then if you're successful with the training, you're successful in the job, you can elevate and go to higher positions. I also think in terms of there's numerous corporations that have headquarters in various cities outside of Rochester, say New York or Philadelphia, Chicago. And we can bring those companies here because if they have to have a presence in New York with the CEO or the CFO, fine, you keep their offices there. But you bring their backroom operations to Rochester where, you know, the operation costs are going to be less, the cost of living is less, and you can employ Rochester people. So I think there's opportunities for us to do that. And that's what I would strive to do in terms of increasing job opportunities for city residents.
Why do you think the mayor and the current administration isn't already doing that? I think that they would say that's exactly part of what they are already doing.
I think, you know, if you reach out and you talk to business people, you talk to the developers, you talk to community organizations, what we found is that the city of Rochester is not necessarily reaching out or not necessarily experienced to make those things happen. For me, the first thing that I would do is put together an experienced economic development team, people who are familiar with the city of Rochester, people who know how to get things done and make this system easier to navigate, because that's one of the things that we've heard as well is that working with the city of Rochester sometimes is hard. It's not transparent. And I think that's what everybody would like, is to be in an environment where it's transparent. They can know the process. And if they don't win, they can understand why they didn't win just based on the fact of the requirements and the process that was followed.
And you talk about putting together a team, and every political leader relies to some degree on people around them. Who are some of the names, if you're willing to share them, of people who you would consult with or would be part of your leadership team?
Excellent question, and I'll be honest with you, I have not put that into my wheelhouse in terms of, you know, putting the cart before the horse. For me, the priority right now is Tuesday. To be thinking about, you know, different departments and different people for different positions is very premature. After Tuesday, my focus would be, you know, November. And then after November, then I would put a team together to help me put a team together. Because I think that reaching out to the people who are most impacted by, you know, the people that you put in place, they should have a role. So, you know, if it's about neighborhood business development, you reach out to the developers and you ask them for some insights in terms of, you know, who they think would serve well in those roles and who they think that they could have good relationships with.
Now, let me grab our first phone call. And listeners, if you want to call the program, James Shepherd running for mayor. He's one of three Democrats running in the Tuesday Democratic primary. Just want to let you know, and we'll let you know multiple times over these 2 hours, we reached out to all three Democrats on the ballot Tuesday after we had to cancel the Voice of the Voter televised debate that was previously scheduled. Once that was canceled, we reached out to the campaigns and said, you know, let's come back and give our listeners and the community a chance to hear from you one more time. And the Shepherd and Barnhart campaigns were able to make that work with their schedules. The mayor was not able to make that work with her schedule, but we certainly hope to talk to her as soon as we can on this program going forward, no matter what happens on Tuesday. Let me grab Larry in Rochester first. It's 844-295-TALK, by the way, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Larry, first up. Go ahead, Larry.
Hi. As a background, I've been a longtime resident of the city, 15 years in Charlotte, then 8 years in the neighborhood of the arts, and the last 3 years downtown. I'm undecided between Jim Shepherd and Rachel Barnhart. If you could remember Evan to ask this of her also, because I see what the format is. My decision process is trying to pick with what I perceive as stability, for want of a better word, with Jim Shepherd versus shaking things up with Rachel Barnhart. I could break either way right now. I'm not sure which way to go. I'd like to hear Jim Shepherd's response. And again, if you can, just remember maybe to ask Rachel that.
Okay.
And I'll be listening. I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Larry, thank you. That's an undecided voter still. Jim, what would you tell him?
I think in terms of, you know, making a decision between the two candidates, I think what's most important is leadership experience. I think in terms of, you know, coming in thinking you're going to dictate what people do, what organizations do, what the people who work for you do, that's not how you lead. What is important is that you take the time to communicate, cooperate, coordinate, collaborate, listen. And you really have to build teams. And that's teams with the community. That could be teams with developers. That could be teams with neighborhood associations. You want to be in a place where, you know, you're not necessarily in charge because you're in charge. It's a matter of you being somebody who can facilitate good things happening. And I believe that that's one of my skills. That's a thing that I've done very well over the course of my police career in different assignments, as well as current assignment or employment that I have now.
All right. Again, it's 844-295-TALK. Listeners, if you want to call the program for Jim Shepherd, who's running for mayor, 844-295-8255. Brent in Rochester emails to say the following. President Trump has decided to lift the limits on military equipment transferred to police departments as part of the 1033 program. A 2014 New York State Freedom of Information reply indicates Rochester has already accepted an MRAP, a mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, in 2014. Would you pursue, accept, or allow the RPD to pursue the transfer of further military equipment? Jim?
I think the issue really isn't necessarily if they obtain the equipment, it's how they use the equipment. You know, I remember back in 1983, there was a bank robbery on Thurston Road. During the course of that robbery, a couple of police officers were shot and left in the street. We had no way of getting them out of the street. At that time, a police captain had to commandeer a garbage truck to be able to roll up and pick this officer up out of the street to protect him. And so that's sort of the move towards using having equipment available for those types of scenarios. In terms of protest, I think that that's overkill, and I think that we need to be very cautious in terms of when we use that equipment. So I think in terms of, you know, scenarios like I described or SWAT calls, you're going to need equipment that protects the officers, protects the community. But when you have in a protest situation, I think we have to be very cognizant that being overly militarized can have the opposite effect of what we're trying to accomplish.
Can you tell the listeners, what is an MRAP?
I don't know what an MRAP is. I'm going to believe that it's a mobile vehicle that is okay. Armor protected so that, you know, if personnel are inside, shots are fired, they will not be injured based on the protection.
All right, so it makes sense to you to have it. You just have to use it judiciously.
Yes, and, you know, and the outcry relative to that equipment has been a result of, you know, when you've had civil unrest and you roll up in these militarized vehicles and people look at it as the military coming in and that the police have a military mindset. So, again, it's not about using it in the wrong circumstances, about using it for the right circumstances. And then there's other circumstances where that might be over-militarized.
Now, one of your predecessors, you were police chief again from what years, Jim?
2010 and 2013.
Okay, so 2010 to 2013. Cedric Alexander is now the deputy mayor of the city of Rochester. He did, I think, about a year as a police chief back in 2005, I want to, something in that range, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the deputy mayor on this program said, and what I want to do is try to characterize what he said and get your take on it, Jim. And Mr. Deputy Mayor, if I'm misquoting you from memory, please correct me. But, you know, we talked about the fact that back in when he was police chief, there was a pretty strong show of force from police to kind of go out into the neighborhoods to be seen, to occasionally be seen with pretty strong weaponry and equipment. And what Mr. Alexander told us on this program was essentially two things. Number one, that most of the residents thanked the police, that they felt like we need a strong presence to feel safe. We need to have the message sent that lawbreakers are not going to be tolerated and that we welcome this. Number two, he said, you know, that was a bit of a different time. 2005 is not 2017, and there's a bit of a different sensitivity to that kind of imagery with police and that kind of equipment in neighborhoods, and you might not do that today. Do you agree with both of those sentiments?
Wholeheartedly. I think that if you look at the history of policing, it's gone through a transition. You know, early in my career, it was about show of force. It was about control. It was about you did occupy neighborhoods. Presently, now you don't want to be occupying force. You want to be a service-oriented organization where people see you as public servants as opposed to military occupying force. And times have changed. You know, at the end of the day, though, I want people to understand that, you know, you opened this up by saying that, you know, people applauded it. And what I've seen, you know, in my career is the fact that, you know, no matter what the police department has done, there's going to be two sides to it. There's going to be people who hate what you do, and there's going to be people who love what you do. And at the end of the day, you just have to do what is right. And in terms of the times, that the way that things have changed, I do believe that, you know, policing in the spirit of service is the way to go, in which we have a culture that is geared towards service to the community as opposed to being an occupying force in those communities.
At last night's debate, the televised debate, you were asked about police accountability and review. And here's something that I admit sort of continues to puzzle me a bit, so you can help me with this. The activists who wrote a recent report on the subject, Barbara Lackerware and Ted Forsyth, they have been very critical of your tenure as police chief, saying that you were essentially reflexively pro-police, that almost no civilian complaints against your officers were ever sustained. You've said that they you know, probably misunderstand the process a bit, that you are proud of your record and that you would defend that process during your tenure as chief. But you still endorse some kind of overhaul of the police conduct review process. And here's what I don't get. Why? If the public simply misunderstands how it works, and if it works as well as you say it did when you were chief, why change it? Why not simply say, hey, let me be the leader who can better explain it instead of overhauling it?
Because at the end of the day, it's all about trust. It's about community trust. And no matter how great you have a system, if the community does not trust it, it's not going to be effective, and it's not going to meet the needs of your community. So at this point in time, and it's been a transition, you know, when we look at police oversight, you know, and I go back to, you know, the 70s, what started off and where we ended up, it has transitioned. It has changed. It has morphed into different ways of doing that business. I think we're at a point in time today in our society where people want to say, you know what, it has to be transparent. We have to have a role. It needs to be independent. Do I believe that as the commanding officer of the professional standards section that I did my job with integrity? I didn't look at it as, oh, I got to cover up for police officers. No. You know, I've said this last night. I'm the only candidate that has investigated police, disciplined police, terminated police, arrested police. And so we did our job. But I do think in terms of one thing that people miss is the semantics of it. You know, if a person calls up and says, I've been robbed, and you go to their house and you find out that while they were at work, somebody broke into their house, it's not a robbery, it's a burglary. And the same thing applies to, say, force complaints. Somebody may say that officer used excessive force. When we look at what actually occurred, it may not be excessive, but it may be inappropriate or it may be unnecessary. So sometimes the semantics of it's going to change and you sustain or not based on the facts that are presented to you.
All right. So let me just give you one example of what, and unfortunately, we've seen a number of high profile national stories of shootings, officer involved shootings. I know you're aware of that. On this program, Monroe County Sheriff Patrick O'Flynn, who's running for re-election, told us he was essentially unfamiliar with the details on the Philando Castile case, which surprised some of our listeners. But the sheriff said, you know, he didn't want to comment too specifically. He wasn't all that familiar. Because I asked him, you know, is that a case of an officer acting inappropriately, going too far. I mean, Philando Castile was essentially telling the officer, I have a permit, I have a weapon, and the officer basically freaked out and shot him 7 times, and he died. Is that a case of what you think is spurring some of the activism? Is the activism justified? Do we look at those cases and say, that's an example of someone of color being treated differently, that if he were a white man, he probably wouldn't have been shot?
I'll take it to another place first and come back to that place. If you look at the case in Chicago, in which the individual, I believe he had a knife, he was walking away from the group of police officers.
Yep.
The officer rolls up in his car, jumps out, shoots him 16 times. Based on the initial investigation, it was stated that the man had charged at the officers and the officer had to defend his life. The investigation with the video basically determined that that was false and that what had happened was what I said. That's the perfect case to say how we're going to investigate and how we reach our outcomes. With the Castile case, the thing that I'm still confused on is the fact of, you know, what did he actually do inside that car? Because even though we have a video where the officer walks up, he talks to the gentleman hands him his, I believe, his license, registration. You can hear him say, I have a weapon. Then you hear the officer say, don't reach, don't reach, don't reach. I don't know what actually happened at that point because the video from inside the car starts after the shooting has occurred. But in terms of what that officer had to deal with, I can't say, and I don't know. So that's the piece that is missing for me relative to his decision to use deadly physical force.
You really don't look at that case and say there's no way that officer should have shot 7 times.
My point is that in terms of the gun, that is, we know it's in play. The gun is there. What did he do with the gun? Did he reach in his pocket and pull it out? Did he just put his hands up and the guy shot him? I mean, those are the facts that need to be put on the table for you to be able to reach that conclusion.
All right, let me grab Tony in Rochester on the phone with Jim Shepard. Go ahead, Tony.
Jim, how are you today, boss?
Very good.
Listen, I got a couple of things that really caught my attention yesterday, and one of them being when Lovely brought up the crime statistics. She emphasized the point that the homicide rate is down. Yet this year, we've had over 160 shootings in this city. Now, if those shots would have hit their victims in the head, there's a good chance we'd have 160 homicides in the city. And I'm just wondering why either you or Rachel didn't jump on that point. And that's one point. My second point is the open drug market. Now, it's obvious that the police are being told to stand down and not do anything to these drug dealers that are out here on the corner. And it's got to frustrate the police department to have to drive by. And I drive by them every day in my line of business. I know exactly where they are, and I'm sure the police know exactly where they are. What would you do to stop this open-air drug market? Thanks. I will take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Tony.
And what was his first question?
Well, let's work backwards. Open-air drug market.
Relative to the open-air drug markets, and that's a slippery slope because that fits into this whole discussion that we have relative to how police police. You can't ignore it just based on the fact that if you ignore it, that's where some of your violence stems from. It's the fact that people own territories. People intrude on those territories. People take guns out and defend their markets. But at the same time, the police can't just be in that occupying force mode where that's all they do is chase people on those corners because at the end of the day, there's other calls going on. There's other priorities going on. And so the Rochester Police Department doesn't necessarily have the resources to address it. One of the things that I would advocate for is to increase the staffing on the police department so that we can have officers out there on the beat doing walking beats, bicycle beats, community engagement assignments, because then you can cut down on those corner activities. But at the same time, I know that enforcement has not addressed that problem in my entire career. We've done a lot of arrests, put a lot of people in jail, but at the end of the day, I arrest you today, somebody else takes your spot. And so, but by having enough officers to have a presence, not so much about enforcement, but just having a presence in the neighborhoods, having a presence on those corners, excuse me, then you can impact what goes on those streets. He mentioned that the officers have been told to stand down. I don't believe that. I think that they're doing the best job they can, but under circumstances, you got calls for service, you got to answer to too.
Jim Shepherd is our guest for the hour. He is running for mayor in Tuesday's primary. We invited all three candidates who are Democrats running for mayor to join us before the election. We made that invitation after the cancellation of the Voice of the Voter debate. I know Mayor Lovely Warren was hospitalized for a number of days after an allergic reaction, and she's feeling better now, but she was not able to fit in a conversation on this program before the election. But you're hearing Jim Shepherd this hour, Rachel Barnhart next hour. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. When we come back, we'll take more of your questions for Jim Shepherd, more what he thinks when it comes to, well, a number of issues. Vacant houses in the city of Rochester, you heard the mayor's plan on that earlier this week. We'll see what Jim has to say about that. Also, some questions from listeners on more on transportation, how we can get access, and his thoughts on poverty as well. It's all coming up on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Rachel Barnhart joins us in studio. The longtime local journalist sits down with us ahead of Tuesday's Democratic primary. She'll talk about her ideas for creating jobs in Rochester, some of her ambitious economic plans, how she's going to bring them about. We'll talk about education in the city of Rochester, downtown development, and a lot more. Rachel Barnhart, next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Barbara in Rochester says, can Jim explain why he didn't vote for 30 years? I think it was 32 years. And I know this has come up. I haven't had a chance to ask you about it on the program. That's Barbara's question. How come you didn't vote for many years?
I registered to vote when I was 18 years old in 1973, lived in Livingston County. I voted every opportunity through 1980. In 1980, we had the Jimmy Carter against Reagan election. The outcome was pretty much like this most recent election where, for me, it was very frustrating. Shortly after that, in January, I was starting the police department. And my thought process in joining the police department was that I felt that it was important that I not be politically affiliated relative to wanting to maintain the integrity of how I did that job. You know, and in my mind, I thought it was important that, you know, if I made a decision to arrest somebody or I made a decision not to arrest somebody using my discretion, it wouldn't be attached to the fact that this person is a Republican, that's why you arrested him, or he's a Democrat, that's why you let him go. You know, in hindsight, we all know what the importance is in terms of getting out the vote and being involved in that process. So I see the value in exercising that right. And at the same time, you know, I look at the last 12 months, you know, looking at the last presidential election and looking at how Comey and his politics got all involved in the presidential election. And it sort of, in a way, it sort of pointed to me why I didn't want to be in that place, you know, because I don't know his rationale. I don't know why his what his motivation was. But a lot of it appears to be that, you know, based on the fact that he was Republican and Hillary Clinton was a Democrat, certain things happened that in my mind should not have happened from a law enforcement official.
Okay. When it Jim, when it comes to the politicization of police, you know, we saw the president stand up in front of a group of police, I think on Long Island recently. And he made those remarks about, hey, you know, when you're arresting someone and you're putting them in the car and you're covering his head and you want to protect them, you don't always have to do that, okay? Essentially saying to the police, you can rough him up. Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the next day the president was kidding. But the police laughed and cheered that. Did that make you uncomfortable?
Very uncomfortable. You know, in my policing career, one of the things that I've always felt was important, that you treat people with respect. You give respect, you get respect. And, you know, during my career as a patrol officer, as a sergeant, working narcotics, working in various proactive units, I took great pride over the fact that if I had to arrest somebody, I arrested them with respect. I took great pride in the fact that nobody said, you know, Jim Shepherd, he arrested me for no reason or he used unnecessary force. It was just the fact that, you know, you did the job, you did it right, and you were able to go home each night realizing that you did it in a way that you could look your children in the face and say, you know, I'm a good policeman. And I think that's very important for him, for the president to take that stance and encourage officers to, you know, you don't have to worry about guiding their head into the car. It's sending the wrong message. And I think in terms of where we are in this country, you know, we're talking about, you know, police accountability boards and, you know, people being upset with how police do their jobs. It was very irresponsible.
All right. Before I jump back to the phones, Holly, Drew, we're coming to you in just a second here. I want to ask Jim about something before we lose a little bit more time, which is that, you know, you have gone hard at Mayor Warren for money in politics, for what the kinds of money that ends up in her campaign coffers. She returned $21,000 after it was disclosed in filings that those she received some contributions over the legal limit, and you kind of went hard at her for that. But did you receive any contributions over the legal limit too, Jim?
Yes, I did. There was an individual who at one point in time, I think, exceeded by $1,000. Once we made that determination, we immediately returned to that individual. And I think it's important to realize that, you know, with the issue with Mayor Warren and her funds, what occurred is that back in their first filing, I believe in February, they identified people who had overfunded and they returned it. And then those same people put money back into the system, which means they went over again. So it was, to me, it was something that could have been avoided if you were paying attention. And that's why we brought it to light. Obviously, people make mistakes. But when you do it a second time, it's not a mistake. It's a decision.
Okay, let's get back to the phone calls. Holly in Rochester next. Go ahead, Holly.
Well, I've been hearing through the campaign lots of questions about what our candidates will do, but I just wanted to make a comment about Jim because I've worked with him for so many years, and it started back in the late 80s, I guess, when he first came and was in charge of our sector in the city, and he was a wonderful captain, I guess, at the time. I may have that wrong, but, you know, he was in charge, and whenever we have a problem, he would address it, and it wasn't just always police issues, but things peripherally involved. But the thing I really wanted to comment on was the fact that he walked every week for years and years with us to go after the code violations in the neighborhood on East Main Street and Winton Road, and he helped us identify problems and then help us clear up this and clean up the street, and whether it was garbage or the code violations with the landlords, et cetera. And then the other thing that he has been doing for us for years is going out on the Day of Caring days and with a wheelbarrow and a shovel and cleaning up around the East High School Stadium, and working with the volunteers. I mean, that's sweat equity. It isn't just sitting behind a desk. And it was really very heartening to see him out there, and it really meant a lot to the neighbors. And I think it's a great example as a politician, to actually get in there and work.
All right, Holly, thank you for the phone call. I suspect Jim will say thumbs up and thank you for that.
No, definitely, I want to say thank you. And she brings up a great point. You know, to me, in the police department, and I believe at the time I was a commander of the East Side. But I think it's very important as a leader to listen to the community. And then in terms of listening, when you pass it on, because you're not going to be able to handle every complaint that an organization may bring to you. But you have to be able to pass it on in such a way so that the people who work for you know that they have to address those issues. You know, a lot of times what happens is somebody will call the chief, and the chief will pass it down the chain. It'll go through about six or seven people, and by the time it gets to the person who has to address that issue, it's just another complaint, just another one coming across my desk. And so you wanted people to know, or I always wanted people to know that, no, it's not just another complaint. This is a citizen who needs help, is reaching out to our organization, and we have to do what's right by that person as best we can.
Drew in Rochester next on the phone with Jim Shepard. Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, just a question. Can Chief Shepard tell us how much money was paid out in civil lawsuits under his tenure? And where can we get that information from?
I wouldn't know that answer on the top of my head. I think that's something you could reach out to the City of Rochester. I believe Corporation Council would be able to keep a tally on that.
What the heck, will we have to go under the Freedom of Information Act?
That might be the best route for you to take in terms of getting the information. I don't know if they would require you to do a FOIL, but if that's the case, submit the FOIL, and I'm sure they'll be happy to give you that information.
Barb in Rochester next. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi, my name is Barb Dietz. I'm concerned about an issue that's come up recently, and I wanted to speak to Jim Shepard about this. Recently, the city council approved some money through the Police Locust Club. We'll be paying the money, but the city council approved the program. A man named Bill Lewinsky to come to town to do some training, quote unquote, with police on something called force science, which is, I think, something he came up with. There's been some research on him. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead, Barb.
Okay. There's been some research on him and a great deal of question and concern about whether his work is a pseudoscience or not. And what he does is talk about the use of force with police and justify it. And a great many people in the community are concerned about this and want to make sure that our police are doing the right thing and caring for people in the way that Jim Shepherd just spoke about. And we're concerned about that, and we want to make sure that happens. And I'd like to ask, as mayor, if he's aware of Bill Lewinsky's work and the problems with it, and what he would say as an administrator in his position as mayor around this.
Okay, thank you, Barb. Go ahead, Jim.
I think in terms of the program that he brings, I don't think it's about him trying to justify, you know, police officers using use of force. My understanding is that what his program is designed to do to give police investigators or police staff an understanding of the physiological things that officers go through when they're involved in a high-stress circumstance. You know, some of the things that I know that occur when, you know, an officer is involved in a shooting incident, you get tunnel vision. You may be deaf based on the fact that, you know, when they ask you how many times did you fire your weapon and you say 3, and the reality is that it was 7. You may not know that happened just based on the way that your body responds both mentally and physically to that stress situation. So with the limited knowledge I have for what he brings to the table, I don't think it's about trying to justify the use of deadly physical force, but it's to give police investigators or the community an understanding of some of the factors that do contribute to what the officer may say or what he may recall or what he doesn't recall. And in some of those instances, it's not so much that they're not telling the truth. It might be they're telling the truth as they know it, even though the evidence will suggest otherwise. And I think they want to bring that understanding. In terms of, you know, how Internal Affairs does an investigation or how the City of Rochester does an investigation, at the end of the day, it's all about getting to the truth and having the evidence that's available to make a good decision as to what occurred. You know, I always talk about it being complete and thorough, fair and impartial. And as long as you have all the facts in place and you have all the information, I don't think you're going to be to a place where you can say an unjustified shoot is justifiable based on science.
All right, let me get to Twitter. Shane wants to know, how would Jim address negative gentrification and promote development without displacement? Before we get into that, because I think there's a couple of different layers to this, I will say development without displacement's come up on this program in a couple of ways. First of all, the Community Land Trust, which was on this program earlier, City Roots, essentially, the City Roots Community Land Trust, is promoting an idea that as a community organization, they would like to see the city adopt their policy of saying, okay, let's say you buy a house for $70,000 in Beechwood, whatever it is. 5 years later, you can't turn around and sell it for $110,000 because of what that impacts the property values, the taxes of everyone around you. That if you get help to buy that house initially for $70,000, there's a cap for what you can turn around and sell it for, which protects the people around you. Another idea I've heard come up is the idea of some kind of gentrification protection for families that have lived in areas, say you live in Neighborhood of the Arts, you've lived there for many years, and now there's more families moving in from out of the area. They're kind of cranking up property values, but all of a sudden your taxes are going way up and it's hard for you to afford that. That if you've lived in a neighborhood for X amount of years, there's a cap for how quickly your property taxes can go up in a certain amount of time. Those are just two ideas. I wonder if you endorse any of those, if you view gentrification as a problem, if you view it technically as a negative most of the time, gentrification is at a negative. So let's start with how you view that issue generally. It's an issue.
Well, I think if you take a neighborhood that is distressed and you want to improve it, gentrification is generally going to be a part of that process. In terms of, you know, dictating that if you buy a house for $70,000 and 10 years later you got to sell it for $70,000, you know, that in a way it goes against the whole getting out of poverty thing, because for a lot of people who have been brought up in poverty, they never were able to obtain homes that, at the end of the day, that's, you know, their what they're going to pass on to their offspring. So I think we need to have a system that takes that in consideration. I love the idea what you talk about in terms of the taxes, you know, and I think it's called a circuit breaker, where you look at the factors. What's the age of the person? How long have they lived in the house? What's their disability, if they have any? What's their fixed income? And you cap those taxes until that person passes that house on or sells it. And that way, nobody's forced out because, you know, in my door-to-doors, knocking and communicating with the citizens, some of them will tell you that you know what, I'm on a fixed income, my taxes keep going up, I'm getting to the point where I have to sell my house because I can't afford the taxes. And that should not be the case. I think we should have a system in place that takes in consideration what you said relative to having a circuit breaker that protects those long-term residents from having to move based on the fact that the values do go up. And I think it is good for the city that values do go up because obviously our tax revenue is based on property values in terms of, you know, poverty and being able to increase wealth in terms of a family. We want them to be able to do that, but we don't want to punish people based on the fact that as a neighborhood starts to get better, they have to move out. And I think that if we put those things in place, we can keep neighborhoods from turning completely from being diverse, because that's what's important for the city too as well, that we have diverse neighborhoods as opposed to neighborhoods that are just totally gentrified and the people who lived there for long times had to move based on tax levels.
Earlier this week, Mayor Warren announced a plan to demolish all 175 of the vacant houses that are on the City of Rochester's demolition list. But other community groups have pointed out there's more than 2,000 vacant houses and properties, so the 175 represents less than 10%, and the question is, what do you do about those? Number one, do you agree with what the mayor's plan is calling for? And number two, do you have an idea on what to do with those remaining 2,000-plus?
Well, in terms of knocking down vacant houses, I know it's important to neighborhoods, communities, when you have a house that's next to you that's been vacant for 10 years and the roof has fallen in and it's decreasing your property values. You know, here we go with the property values again. People find it that they, if they do want to sell, that they may not be able to sell it what their house is really valued at based on the fact that it's surrounded by houses that are falling apart. But at the same time, I realize that with the 2,000 properties that we have out there, we have to come up with a different strategy to address those. You know, in my platform, I talk about Clean Sweep 2.0, where we take advantage of taking a property, working with some of our nonprofits, working with our trade unions to help teach young adults the trades. And you can pick a house, you can pick a block. And you take a block and you start to fix it up. You do the painting, you do the woodwork, you do the roofing, and you do the plumbing, and you do the things that where these kids can get some skills so that they can get a job that pays a living wage. So I think there's some other alternatives that we can put in place as opposed to just looking at demolishing these houses. One of the things that I don't like when I walk in neighborhoods is the fact that you see a lot with the post up. It sort of tells you that, you know, you're in a bad neighborhood because you have these lots with the post. One of the things I'd love to see is that, you know, a lot of these lots are so small that nobody's going to come put a house on them. And we need to acknowledge those, make their assessments, and then take opportunities to give those properties to the adjacent homes.
A few minutes left with Jim Shepherd, who is running for mayor in the City of Rochester. Tuesday is primary election. We'll have live coverage starting at 9 p.m. on primary night right here on WXXI. I'll be here. Randy Gorbin, our news director, will be here. We'll all be here. And hope your ears will be on WXXI radio on Tuesday night. I think it was back in January. You announced back in January?
Yes.
All the way back in January.
Seems like 100 years ago.
Doesn't it to you? And I think in that initial conversation, if I remember correctly, you told me that, you know, you found the idea of a countywide school district pretty appealing on many levels, but you weren't sure there was the political will. 8-plus months later, here we are getting ready for the primary. Where do you stand? If you are mayor, if you win on Tuesday, there's a really good chance you're going to be mayor. What is a Mayor Shepherd going to do in regards to either advocating for countywide schools, or maybe you still think not politically feasible, or, you know, the most ambitious educational proposal that's on the table that you think is achievable is what?
If you look for me, and looking down the road, looking for my vision, countywide school district is nirvana. That's perfection. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I know it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I also believe that the political will has increased. You know, Great Schools for All, they've been doing surveys. They've been reaching out to the suburban parents to see if they'd be interested in more diversity in their schools. And they're finding that people really want their children to grow up in diverse environments. At the same time, I realize that we have to take small steps. And one of the things I will advocate for is to have a regional magnet school on the foundation of School of the Arts or Edison Tech, where we can recruit kids from all over the county to go to schools that are diverse in terms of economics and ethnicity, and let those be our experimentals, and we can build on that as well. Also, another idea for that is having a STEM school, science, technology, engineering, and math, where, again, you know, those are the fields of the future. I think that anybody in the county, if there was a school that was focused on those areas, they would take advantage of it. And again, I think in terms of diffusing the concentration of poverty in the city, the concentration of minorities in our school district, that would be a great step forward. At the end of the day, I think the role of the mayor is to be a strong advocate for the citizens and the students in the city of Rochester, to work with the school district so that we are moving the agenda forward. We have to follow the data and do things that move that data. You know, we talk about reading levels. You know, third grade reading level is 8%. 10 years from now, those kids are going to struggle because they don't have reading skills. Right now, in eighth grade, reading proficiency is 1%. For all the jobs that we're talking about that could come to Rochester that are high-tech, photonics, imaging, optics, they're going to need those math skills. And so we have to prepare students to be successful in the future world that is coming. And having the opportunity to be in diverse regional schools could be a great start.
Couple more minutes with Jim Shepherd. Paul on Twitter wanted to know about jobs and transportation. How to get workers access to jobs. Now, earlier this hour, you said, look, if Amazon wants to choose Rochester and they're going to bring 20,000 or 50,000 jobs, well, you're going to go to RTS and we're going to set up a direct line right to Amazon. But that's probably not going to happen. So set that aside. Right now, I feel like every 6 months we have a conversation about how to get more direct access transit lines, and that hasn't really changed even after a couple of years after the anti-poverty initiative. Or maybe I'm wrong. How do you view access to jobs, and what would your administration do differently specifically?
I think we have to recognize the fact that for people to be employed, they have to be able to get to the jobs, and those jobs are not necessarily going to be around the corner. One thing that we can do is to collaborate with RTS to change the routing. You know, one of the things that you hear is that somebody who works in Henrietta takes them 90 minutes, 2 hours to get to work. I think part of that might be related to the fact that they have routes that are not designed to get people to those workplaces. So working with RTS, we can have direct routes. You pick them up at the transit center. You don't stop till you get there. They do that with the schools right now to have cut down on some of the issues at the transit center. I think we can do that with our businesses that are not just in the city of Rochester, but in the surrounding area as well, so that we can get people to work. I know that we've had conversations relative to the van sharing, and I think Uber is another situation that can help in terms of people getting to work. At the end of the day, we have to overcome the obstacles. So if transportation is an obstacle, then we have to sit down as a community and decide how can we make that no longer be an obstacle for people getting to work. The only way people are going to get out of poverty, we know, is for people to get a job, and so we have to be able to get those jobs and then be able to get them to those jobs.
Parcel 5 is an issue that's been coming up all year long. We're not that far away from the end of the year now, and the question is when the city administration might put it in front of city council, either before the end of the year or perhaps with a new council, or at least partially new council, depending on the results of the election coming up next year. The mayor says, she said last night at the debate, it's not just about a performing arts center. It's about permanent jobs. It's about the right plan for that site. You have been vehemently against that. Remind our listeners specifically what a Mayor Jim Shepherd would do with Parcel 5.
What I would have liked to have done with Parcel 5 is to have a community-involved process in which we defined what we wanted to see on that site. Lacking that community engagement and having a vision for Parcel 5 really has hurt our efforts to do anything there. I think the community has made it very clear that putting a performing arts center on that site is not in the community's best interest. I think in terms of us wanting to be downtown, to be a diverse, everybody welcome environment, it does not fit that agenda. And I think in terms of what we do there should be something that everybody in the city of Rochester feels they're welcome and they can afford to go there. And so the whole history of Parcel 5 really, in my opinion, has been about Arnie Rothschild building him his downtown performing arts center. And if you go through the history of the ideas that have been put forth, you know, it started off with a water park, then a movie theater, then it was a performing arts center with a casino, performing arts center with retail, and now performing arts center with retail and residential. So in my mind, having a closed view on that, and not having vision, and I stress the vision piece too, because a lot of people have put money into the surrounding area of Parcel 5. And if they knew what was going to be there, that might impact their decision-making. And I think if you had a vision, everybody was on board, and everybody had come together to define that vision, I think we would have a much better idea of what we need to do there.
30 seconds. Last night, the closing question is one that I think needs to be asked again here, which is, can you actually unite the Democratic Party? You know, a lot of people think you represent a faction that is still kind of at political war, and that why would you be able to do it, Jim?
Based on the fact that, you know, as much as people say, well, Shepard hasn't been involved in politics for 30 years, well, that I think is a plus, because I don't carry the baggage, I don't have the animosities, I don't have the grudges that other people have. I think that, you know, Lincoln made the point when he became president to reach out to his adversaries to build a team, and I think that's what has to happen, is that we have to come together, make the decision as Democrats, what is best for our city, and work together to make it happen. We will have disagreements. We may not all be on the same page, but the fact of the matter is, if we'll be keeping our focus is what's best for the city of Rochester and its residents, we will be able to work together.
We'll see you Tuesday night. Jim Shepard, running for mayor. Thank you for the time, as always, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
He is running for mayor, one of three Democrats on the ballot for Tuesday night. If you're just joining us, that's The Hour with Jim Shepard. Next hour, Rachel Barnhart. Mayor Lovely Warren declined our invitation for one more hour before the primary. Says a very busy schedule. We certainly understand that. But Rachel Barnhart is next.